Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is filmmaker Kathy Lee Crane. Crane is a graduate of both San Francisco State University and Sarah Lawrence College. She has been making narrative documentary hybrid films since 1994. Her first feature film, Pasolini's Last Words, was released in 2012 and premiered at the Festival of New Cinema in Montreal. Her short films have been broadcast on European television and have won many awards. She received a prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship in 2013, and Crane is currently an associate professor in the Department of Cinema, Photography, and Media Arts at Ithaca College. And welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Tish. Thanks for having me.
Now, I always want to start at the beginning. What was it that got you into film? What was it that made you turn this into a profession?
I was studying philosophy, and I saw the work of an American avant-garde pioneer, Maya Deren. Seeing that work enabled me to imagine a kind of filmmaking that could use real locations to articulate psychological or emotional landscapes.
Uh-huh. But so when you decided that you wanted to go into filmmaking, you'd never done it before.
Ever.
You didn't know what the form was. And
no, I was working in the music business. I was in management. I was doing, you know, I was not my own creative artist. Let's put it that way. but that really struck my mind. It was profound.
Yeah.
And immediate.
Film does seem like some kind of a place where you can splash your dreams and philosophies onto.
That was actually in a class at Sarah Lawrence, and so we were given this crazy camera called the Bolex, which is all these knobs. It's a spring-wound camera that stops after 24 seconds. It's like, wait a minute. And I was completely freaked out by this animal. And my teacher said, this is an instrument to see how it is you see. And with that, I decided this was a really deep philosophical journey I could take with this particular tool.
Yeah.
And I've used that camera ever since.
Wow.
Yep.
Tell us, what was your first subject in your first film? What was it about?
Myself. I woke up from the middle of a dream. I had three rolls of reversal black and white film and had a very clear image of being very low to the desert ground. And I was born and raised in Arizona, so I have an affinity for desert landscapes. And I just asked my friends, I was in Tucson, Arizona at the time, I have some ideas of doing something. It was very Maya Deren. It was a split protagonist, a woman who sees herself, which is very much like her, all of her films really have that kind of split self. And I was just dealing with the death of a friend to AIDS, and it was an opportunity to express my feelings about that.
I was going to say explore your feelings in that way.
So there's a burial involved, even though it was sort of after the burial, just knee and dirt. So when I first moved to San Francisco, I took a class at City College, which was an editing class. I thought, well, I've got all this footage. I'll finally make the film, finish it. And the assignment that we had in the class was to edit a scene from Gunsmoke. And I said
really?
To the professor, I said, can I actually just edit my own material? She goes, totally.
Yeah. Oh, well, how strange. What a strange way to begin. It would make some people split. Now, your major endeavors have been documentary film. Tell us how you go about this. You come up with an idea and then start doing research? Do you start filming excerpts?
Yeah, sometimes I'm a hunter, sometimes I'm a gatherer.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I have a very particular point of view and something I want to capture. Like, for instance, I made a film that was an adaptation of André Breton's surrealist novel, Nadja. And in that novel, there's very specific photographs that chart his relationship in the streets of Paris with this strange woman. So I knew I was going to go to Paris with my Bolex and go to each and every one of these sites and embody with my handheld camera a different point of view of those places that had been photographed. But other times, I just find myself in a place like with my film Sketches After Halle, driving through from Dresden to Leipzig, this town called Halle, and I just was so struck by its complete sort of devastation. This is 1991, so just after unification. I just said, I have to go back there. I don't know why, but I have to go back there. And I just started shooting whatever caught my eye with my Bolex, and I didn't even process that film for another year. And then I didn't even edit it for another 5 years.
Wow, that's called really percolating, isn't it, with an idea.
Well, what was great about that is that then I looked at the footage as if someone else had shot it.
Mm.
And it was trying to recover a memory I had been there. I was the one who actually captured that moment in slow motion or whatever. But it sort of introduced me to the idea that understanding history, even one's own history, is about sifting through a certain set of archival remnants.
Uh-huh. As a documentary filmmaker, do you have to worry about bringing people's personal stories into this and getting permissions and being sensitive? Or do you have artistic freedom to do what you want?
Well, that's the beauty of the hybrid, because I fictionalize things. There's always something that's, like, for instance, the biography I did about Simone Weil. It's a biography. It's rooted in an understanding of and a reading of what she was thinking about during the last two years she spent in France.
This film was called The Impossible Life Of, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested in historical accounts, actually, that take into account the fact that the interpretation we make of history is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
There are data points that actually we can all agree happened.
Yeah.
There's some physical evidence that's true. But the master narrative of understanding causes and implications are ours, and they change. So part of me is going back into the historical record, the archive, and imagining being there. So strangely, that Sketches After Holothing film involved my also in being in that town, encountering these paintings by this painter, Lionel Feininger, who I had never even heard about. I then went into all these letters he was writing at the time, 30 or 60 years prior, when he was doing paintings of that town. And I suddenly opened out onto this history of the woman who had translated these letters into English, which was his wife.
Wow.
And then I got interested in the concept of sort of the absence of certain stories.
Uh-huh.
It's a kind of feminist project, I think.
Well, I was going to ask you this. As a documentary filmmaker, do you feel like you sort of need to use film as a weapon or as a political statement? How do you deal with that?
I'm still governed by this drive of wanting to see something new in things we think we understand. And I do consider myself also a narrative filmmaker. I don't think it's exclusively the document. In fact, I think that the unique thing I am doing is that I am blending them. I'm working with staged material. I'm oftentimes interpreting fictional texts. Like this new piece that I'm working on at Ithaca College, I'm just starting a class tonight around, is a fiction.
Mm.
But it's rooted in a historical account of what was happening in New York during World War I, before we actually entered the war, but while the war was already raging in Europe.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot to say about what it meant to maybe live. I was interested primarily. It came from an autobiographical source, that film, let's say, the story of my grandmother, who was adopted by a butcher in the Bronx in 1917.
Oh,
so I was interested in knowing who her mother could have been. What was it like to have been a woman in New York who gives birth in 1914?
Mm.
What were they doing? What were women doing?
That's a good question, you know, and you have to map out a little place in time, because women were doing different things in different towns. Interesting.
So it's exciting. You know, I'm into, like, progressive politics, so I'm tuning into the history of the Wobblies and, you know, a very strong socialist core to the American history of the 20th century that is all but erased from the master narrative of what it means to be an American.
Yeah, so we can create history by just uncovering stuff that's been
written.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, some of your films have been shot in black and white. You even won an award for a black and white film. What's going on with, why is black and white leaving the culture? I absolutely love black and white film.
I do too. So there's a number of things I can say about that. But the first would be that it is always already abstract.
It's black and white itself,
yes,
you mean?
Yes, it's already a conceptual proposal. So in that way, it's great because it opens up a sort of almost a mythical way. It also is linked to a very particular time in cinematic history when all films were black and white.
Yeah, yeah.
I also work very closely with trying to weave my stage material with archival material. And much of that is black and white. And much of that is also an aspect ratio that is square, unlike the HD moment where how wide can we go? I'm interested in the square of an old newsreel. Mm. And that's why I still use my Bolex, too, because the material, it lives more closely with some of these archives that I'm interested in exploring. And I love contrast.
Yeah. I mean, black and white seems like more of an art form to me, more of a challenge. I mean, just like black and white photography. You worry about light and shadow more, and it shows nuance. It shows mystery much more than color film. Well, what do you think about the digital culture that we've created around filmmaking and, you know, still camera? I've talked to photographers. It's a different world.
It is, and I think still to do it well, one needs to know how to light a scene. Hmm. And needs to know how to determine certain values in a scene. Not everything can be done in post.
Is it different than traditional film then, using digitals?
It's radically different, but I think they're trying to find some way in which it might be comparable. Certainly, it's got a level of resolution now and with some cameras and some optics that are really quite interesting and really hard to tell that it's a digital image, actually, especially if it's lit well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people forget about that when they go into filmmaking, right? It's not just you and your camera and your vision. You've got to be able to do
lighting.
Not only
do you have to light
composition.
It. Right, so I can adjust the thing on my camera and I go, oh, see, I can record something in this really dark corner. It's like, right, and look at all that noise in your image. You can do it. So they're more sophisticated, the cameras. You can now do that, you know, be in a low-light situation and not get all of that video noise that was more... Uh-huh. I think it's beautiful. I've shot a short in HD. I'm not a Luddite, but I'm really committed to the fine art of cinema. And so I'm interested in when the commercial industry moves in a different direction towards digital, which is what's happening. Mm. We have this tool now, the 16mm film and camera, that can now be considered for its own properties. And this is why the only place really you can find a 16mm film projection on a 16mm film projector is in a gallery.
Ah, that's the difference now.
In a way, that's where it's going.
Well, you know, no matter what kind of tools one has, one still has to have a vision, be able to tell a story, you know, be able to communicate with somebody who you obviously want to see and participate in these films that you make, right?
I would like to have a larger audience. That would be nice to. Every time I show my work, my favorite part is having a conversation afterwards with the audience. Uh-huh. Really, because my work is more like music or still images or paintings. One would want to look at my films more than once because they're extremely dense, and so sometimes just one viewing is not enough.
If you're just joining us, my guest is filmmaker Kathy Lee Crane. Now, I want to talk to you about your first feature. It was Pasolini's Last Words. What got you interested in him? I'm obviously a great filmmaker, an intellectual, a poet, interesting man, murdered, assassinated in the mid-70s.
I had not seen his films. I'd just finished graduate school, and I was showing my film, The Girl from Marseille, at the San Francisco International Film Festival in 2002, and I saw a documentary about him. And in it, he was saying that he was working on a novel called Petrolio, about oil.
Mm.
And I was, my interest was piqued because I thought to myself, well, what's this guy doing writing about oil in the 1970s? I mean, you know, it seems obvious, potentially. So I got his book, Petrolio, which had been translated, though was out of print, in English. And it blew my mind.
Ah.
It just blew my mind. He didn't finish it, so it's a very fragmentary text. He was working on it when he was murdered in 1975. So I began to read more and more of him, actually. And it was through his writing. I would say that there, and I've said this before, but it's really true for me. I could not make films if I did not read.
Oh, yeah.
And all of my work comes from reading. Some literary text, some biographical text, some fiction. There's a book from every place Every film I make comes from a book.
You know, I think intellectually people need to read to do any form of art, you know? So it seems like common sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also this practice of the figurative. And for me, I read slowly because while I'm reading, I see images.
Really?
Those are my films. That my films come from reading. So that was no exception. Of course, the deeper I got into Pasolini and his Marxism in particular, I became very impressed at how prescient he was in the 70s critiquing consumer capitalism, which basically had completely decimated Italy in their quote-unquote economic miracle, post-war economic miracle, and he didn't see much of a difference between the fascism, capital F, of Mussolini and the fascism, little f, of capitalism.
Yeah, and I understand his take on that as well, especially nowadays. And so Pasolini's last words, did you actually deal with the assassination and
yes,
use some of the final words in that unfinished novel?
Right.
And
some of his last interviews. And basically, I then focused my attention on the last year of his life. So everything he was writing at the time. He was publishing articles on the front page of the daily paper. There were these polemical screeds against the governing powers. And, you know, they're radical. They're really radical.
Oh, I'm sure they must be.
They're phenomenal.
They must be. So
I wanted to just serve him. So all the words are his in the film.
How interesting, yeah. I know. I was very interested when I heard that you had actually done a film like that. I would like to see it. You also collaborate with other people.
I do.
And how does that work? Did somebody ask you? You ask them? You have to be simpatico about the project?
You know, it depends. I've done a number of collaborations with a particular actress who I've known for decades, Lee DeLong. She's an American who has been living in Paris for 30 years. So she has been in a number of my films, and that's just a real deep understanding of we trust each other, you know. And I've made 4 films that have been scored by Beth Custer, who's one of the founding members of Clubfoot Orchestra out of San Francisco, who did original scores for silent films. And she and I work intuitively, really. I think for whatever reason, we have a very comparable rhythm. Mm-hmm. And when she sees my editing, she relates to it as an instrument, as a track. And so her score is very much in tune. She builds a melody with the rhythm of my own cutting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that to me is a sensibility that she just simply possesses.
So you like collaborating with people?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a lot of filmmakers do want to stay in charge and in control of...
Well, I don't know how to play the clarinet.
So you do need to collaborate, of course. But I was just wondering, because sometimes it's just you and one other person, it seems.
Yeah, but then also I've worked as a cinematographer for other people earlier in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just about enabling a kind of vision to manifest. I very early, actually, after about 5 years of doing that for other people, realized that I couldn't do it for anybody. I had to do it for someone whose worldview or point of view was something I could respond to. It's like I could never be a commercial cinematographer for Jell-O.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it just doesn't, it's not something before the frame that really entices me to linger.
Yeah. Are you influenced by some of the famous, at least in some circles, like Barbara Hammer, Meredith
She's
Monk?
Great.
You know, I mean, some of these people who make avant-garde queer films. Barbara Hammer, obviously, is considered a pioneer of queer cinema.
She is. We just, she finished a piece, an installation piece about Pasolini in the last year as well. So she and I actually had the opportunity this past November to show our work at the Aurora Picture Show in Houston. It was fantastic. It was like a perfect communion of pieces, problematizing contemporary engagements. She was dealing with Palestine, so dealing with the impossible politics that in fact Pasolini would talk about as like, and what about us, the bourgeois witnesses? You know, what does it mean? How? And this is something he struggled with himself. Mm-hmm, he's a bourgeois, you know, upper middle class intellectual. And he had a really deep obsession and concern for the proletariat.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always been a problem in the history of.
Yeah, but you delve deeper into it and want to show people exactly what you mean by it with visuals, you know.
Well, I let the film, my Pasolini film, lets language settle in over other sections that are completely silent, and watching figures move through space or considering some of his own images differently. Digesting. There's spaces in that film for digestion.
Uh-huh. That's what makes a good film. Otherwise, it would be a propaganda film.
I'm learning that.
Correct?
I'm still learning. I make a mistake, at least one, in every film I make and have to take that to my next film project.
You know what I want to ask you about? It says on your biography on the Ithaca College website that one of your specialties is directing actors for film. What's the deal with that? Is it a specialty to teach people to act on film rather than theater?
It's a specialty to indoctrinate young directors into the fine art craft of acting. Mm. Because I think oftentimes my students who are all undergraduates, you know, stage actors as props and don't think of what they could be doing or how to work better with non-actors even. Mm. Mm-hmm. And this all began because I kind of failed in my film about Simone Weil in terms of how I worked with my actors. I mean, I had to build the performance of my lead, and not her fault. She's a non-actor.
Oh.
But I gave language to her and other actors and non-actors that was written language, not spoken language.
Oh.
And I had the obscene thought that I was working with Brechtian alienation when, in fact, I was simply failing. Because Brecht, as I then subsequently really understood, is meant to be shared. You're meant to be sharing the physical space with a being who is both the being and a being that they are attempting to portray.
Mm.
And that movement and tension between those poles of the mask or the social mask is really what he was getting at with alienation, not being totally immersed, I think.
So did you have to rewrite the language to make it more
no,
spoken?
No, I had to make another film and I had to go study acting. Like if I, you know, so I did. I know, I did. I went and I actually studied in Ithaca at the Actors Workshop.
Oh.
I only did 3 semesters there. I didn't do all 5, but it was a radical shift for me to think about the act of listening.
Yeah. I've often wondered whether, I've asked directors, do you need to be able to act or at least know something about acting in order to really translate anything onto the stage and or the film?
Yes.
And everybody has said yes.
No question.
You must be able to. Have you ever done any acting yourself, though?
Well, I mean,
besides when you took the classes?
That's pretty much what I've done.
Uh-huh.
I did theater in high school. You know, I wasn't.
Well, that counts.
I
That's
cried.
When you're most self-conscious, you know. You cried?
I cried on stage in an exercise in The Heiress, you know, where I played Catherine. So I was having a deep relationship to that.
Do you feel like you were any good as an actress?
I think I was probably too self-conscious.
Mm.
And I have become increasingly aware that the camera pays very close attention to that. And if you are, it will definitely come across as bad
absolutely.
Acting.
Yes, and we see a lot of that, actually.
We do.
In cinema.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. Now, I want to talk about the fact that you won that Guggenheim fellowship. Did that change you as a filmmaker? What are you doing with it?
It was radical. I mean, you know, it's a major award, and it's a recognition of what I've done up until this point, and it's kind of moves me into a category that's not about it being an emerging filmmaker, but saying I'm a mid-career.
Yeah, you've arrived. Yeah.
So I felt like a really great vote of confidence to continue to make the kind of work I make, which are these strange, odd historical forays, trying to like, I almost feel like I'm trying to make a home movie of the lives that are just completely missing from the historical record.
Ah.
Like I'm building new documents that can be folded into that record.
Isn't that amazing? Even in 2014, where there's still so many lives that are not even portrayed in the culture.
Yeah.
You know, we in the early days of the feminist movement, we were unearthing all kinds of women writers and,
yep.
and women's history. But it continues. It continues. The dance continues. There's still all these hidden lives that no one knows about.
Well, and it's always this question, like, why are you making the film you're making now? And I had to confront that question as it related to making the Simone Weil film. Why was I concentrated on her life during the occupation, German occupation of France? Mm. What was she writing at that time? She was writing a story about mercenaries in Spain and in the 16th century. So why was she looking back in the moment in which she was? And, and I know why I was in 2003 starting to work on her film, on a film about her. It was because she wrote about violence in a way that made me understand and be able to articulate how obscene I thought that our response to September 11th was.
Oh, yes.
Like obscene. Yes.
That's going to reverberate throughout our history. Yeah. We haven't even unveiled what was happening, you know, and what has happened since then, how it's changed our soul.
Yeah. I mean, she has written an extraordinary essay, Simone Weil, on violence as it's portrayed in the Iliad. It should be required reading for absolutely everyone on the planet, I think. It's a small essay, and it says everything I need to know about violence. But I continue to go back to the problem of war and the problem of violence, certainly through Pasolini and most definitely in my current film.
Kathy, we only have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you about women directors. And is it easier in the documentary world for women to surface and find a place?
And definitely. And I think the technology and the ease with which we have access to those technologies and the funding sources that exist for documentary all make it possible to make work. But there's a lot of women who are doing fiction work now, too, and that's super exciting, really exciting. But you're not going to see them on the Academy Awards show.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That number is still ridiculous in the industry. But I think the industry is changing, and it's changing because it has to change. And systems of distribution are not only the purview of a few, even though one could argue that they still control most of the channels. There are ways in which you can cultivate your own audience now. Yeah. And so you find the 1,000 people in the world, around the world, who want to be in dialogue with the kind of work you're making.
Yeah, yeah.
And not only as a receiving end, I'm a viewer, but as a funder. I mean, you know, crowdsourcing is a huge way in which independent cinema is being financed.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is fantastic.
The world is changing in a good way
great.
In that aspect. Any film we can look forward to in the near future coming up, maybe being screened somewhere here?
I don't think I have anything lined up in Ithaca anytime soon. No, I've already shown Pasolini at Cornell Cinema. I think I should show it again, actually.
I think you should, too.
Yeah.
So we're going to look forward to that.
Okay, great.
How about contact information real quick?
Well, my website is Kathy Lee Crane, both are with C's, Kathy and Crane, .com. And that has updates on what I'm doing next and what I've just done and that kind of thing.
Great. Well, Kathy Lee Crane, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.